Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Vatican sends a delegation to Istanbul to mark Tuesday's Feast of St. Andrew and to discuss ecumenical cooperation with Orthodox leaders. And 30 years on, Mary Knoll missionaries lead commemorations in countries around the world, recalling the four American women murdered in El Salvador, where they worked with the poor and oppressed. November 30th marks the feast day of St. Andrew, the first disciple, celebrated as patron saint by the Ecumenical Patriarchate and many other Christian churches in both the East and Western world. To mark the occasion each year, the Vatican sends a delegation to celebrate with the Ecumenical Patriarch, Bartholomew I, at the headquarters of the Orthodox Church in Fana, Istanbul. In a message sent to Patriarch Bartholomew this week, Pope Benedict said, "In a world characterized by increasing interdependence and solidarity, we are called to proclaim the truth of the gospel with renewed conviction and to present the risen Lord as the response to the most profound spiritual questions and aspirations of men and women today. In order to do this," the Pope added, "we must continue along the path towards full communion, showing that we have already united our strengths for a shared witness of the gospel." And he assured the Patriarch of the interest with which he follows, quote, "your wise efforts for the good of Orthodoxy and for the promotion of Christian values in many international contexts."
Andrew, the brother of Peter, becomes a forceful symbol of the kind of embrace that we would like to see between East and West.
Leading the delegation to Istanbul this year were the President and Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, Cardinal Kurt Koch, and Bishop Brian Farrell, who also held talks with their Orthodox counterparts on some of the most pressing issues on the ecumenical agenda. I spoke with Bishop Farrell just ahead of his departure for Turkey to find out more about this joint celebration and the common witness of the two churches in that majority Muslim nation. Bishop Brian Farrell, you're going over to Istanbul to mark the Feast of St. Andrew, this routine exchange of delegations celebrating the patron saints of the East and Western churches. Yes. Tell us, first of all, how this tradition began.
Well, it became a logical outcome to great efforts that were being made in the 70s and 80s to find ways to express the communion that already exists between the churches. And it seemed that one of the ways to do this was to actually celebrate the feast of each other. And so this tradition began, and it's now, I think, towards its 30th year. And you called it routine. That's true. But routine doesn't necessarily mean that it's less significant. On the contrary, something that lasts, that goes on, is something that has proven the test of time and is an expression then of the depth of our relationship, even when we still have so much to do to actually reach the day when we can celebrate.
This is the first visit, of course, by your new president here at the Council for Christian Unity, isn't it?
Yes, I think that this will be an interesting aspect of the visit. The Patriarch will have an opportunity to meet him. I'm not sure that it's the first time, but certainly in this capacity as president of the Pontifical Council. I think the Patriarch will see that he is totally committed to the cause, that he has not just a wonderful theological understanding of the ecumenical path that we're trying to discover and follow, but that personally he's a very charming and gentle kind of person. And what more can you want for ecumenical in relationships?
Beyond the liturgical celebrations, is this a chance really also to talk through recent developments in the dialogue?
Yes, every year when we go and when they come here, we set aside a whole morning for a formal conversation with those responsible for relations between the churches. And we have an agenda which we have already worked out, and we will be able to speak on the things that are of interest to us. And this is very, very important.
Can you give us some insight as to what is topping that agenda this time?
As always, an important part of the agenda is the theological dialogue, the process. So now, in this particular year, we will be discussing how we are both going to institute this new ad hoc commission that will have to develop a new working paper on the role of the Bishop of Rome in the first millennium in a theological sense. And then we will also, this year I would say that the focal point of the visit will be a reflection on what people call common witness, shared witness, or joint witness. In other words, this year we have had an important meeting between the European bishops' conferences and the Orthodox churches on this whole question of how Christians have to face the challenges of today's society, in Europe especially.
What about the question of finding a common date to celebrate Easter? This has been high on the agenda, particularly the North American Orthodox and Catholic churches have been pushing hard for this, haven't they?
This has been on our agenda from the time of the Second Vatican Council. It is a quite simple question for us Catholics, because we have already said that we would be willing to accept any solution. It is not quite so easy for the Orthodox Church, where you have those who use the modern Gregorian calendar, but you have a large portion of Orthodox who believe that it is dogmatically important to keep the old Julian calendar, because that would be more in the infidelity to the ancient traditions of the Church. And so it's very difficult to move towards a joint date.
So it seems unlikely that there will be a solution to this in the near future.
Well, yes, it's at the present time, there's no hope that this will happen. But in the near future, we hope that there will be the Pan-Orthodox Synod, which is being prepared, has been in preparation for a long time, and which now looks like it is coming closer and closer. If there could be a discussion on this, we don't know what progress might be made.
Let's return a moment to the figure of St. Andrew. He is the patron saint of the Eastern churches, but he's also a very significant figure for the West, isn't he?
He is. He is, above all, the first called, the first of the disciples. And it was he who called Peter then. Andrew is certainly cherished in a special way by the Orthodox churches, but as we can see, he is also well known, and there is great devotion to him in parts of the West. Just to take one example, we have Edinburgh and St. Andrew in Great Britain. There are hundreds of churches dedicated to St. Andrew. It's logical that the apostles are all present everywhere in the church because they are intrinsic to the New Testament. But in this case, Andrew, the brother of Peter, becomes a forceful symbol of the kind of embrace that we would like to see between East and West.
Finally, beyond the important celebration of this feast, the presence of a Catholic delegation there in Fana, supporting and standing beside the ecumenical patriarch, how much does this help, perhaps, in the struggle that the patriarch is continuing to try and have, for example, many of the properties returned to it?
Well, in recent times, we see hopeful signs of an improvement of this situation. The Holy See has always defended the patriarch and his right to the title of ecumenical patriarch. And on many occasions, either the Pope personally or our office, we have made a point of drawing attention to his role, his specific role. You know, the purpose of our delegation is not to defend him, but to actually celebrate the feast of the patriarchate. But if it serves that purpose, and I think it has down the years, especially in decades past or in recent times, but in years past, it was more important because the pressure was greater. Now I think for all minorities in Turkey, there is the hope that a more satisfactory situation will develop as Turkey increasingly comes closer to the European set of principles.
The recent decision by the European Union for the return of the orphanage, that's quite a significant step, isn't it, for the Orthodox Church?
It's an important step. It's only one of many steps that can be taken and need to be taken. Of course, the Ecumenical Patriarch has always pointed to the need to open the Halki school. We can only hope that things will improve.
My thanks there to Bishop Brian Farrell, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. Their names are not as well known as Archbishop Oscar Romero, yet they were murdered in the same country for the same cause, an unwavering commitment to the poor, the homeless, and those caught in the crossfire of El Salvador's violent political conflict. American Mary Knoll sisters Maura Clark and Eta Ford, Ursuline sister Dorothy Kazel, and lay missionary Jean Donovan were beaten, raped, and murdered by members of El Salvador's National Guard on December 2, 1980. Following an international outcry, five men were subsequently found guilty of the crimes and sentenced to 30 years in jail, though three were released after serving less than half of that time. Though a UN-sponsored truth commission found clearly that the abductions and murders were carried out on orders from El Salvador's military leaders, no one has ever been held responsible. On the 30th anniversary of their deaths, the legacy of these women was celebrated in countries around the world, and in a special way by the New York-based Mary Knoll community of men and women religious and lay missionaries.
The thing about them is, as somebody else has said, they were just ordinary people who did extraordinary things and became extraordinary.
Sister Patricia Murray also worked for over 15 years in Central America and knew the murdered women well. Today, she's based at the Mary Knoll headquarters, where she coordinates retirement and renewal programs for the sisters. But back in the 1970s and 80s, she was part of the dedicated team of women religious, bringing practical and spiritual support to the oppressed and suffering majority of people in Central America, caught up in a Cold War conflict playing out in their lands. I talked to Sister Patricia about her memories of these martyrs and the legacy they left behind after their deaths.
All of them have wonderful senses of humor. Maura was Irish background, and she loved to dance, and she would always do the Irish jig for us when we had a party or anything. Eta was like a little pixie, and she had a very dry sense of humor. She was very intelligent, used to be the one who analyzed things very well. Dorothy was, people said of Dorothy, she was an alleluia from head to toe. And she was just a very joyful person. And Jean was young, she was enthusiastic, she was impulsive at times, but she was always very dedicated and just couldn't do enough for people. Very, very kind person.
Tell us something about the work they were doing there in El Salvador.
Well, given the situation that was reigning in the country at that time, it was really a state of civil war. And so there wasn't a whole lot you could do in the way of organized, structured work. So the Mary Knoll sisters up in Chalatenango were doing a lot of refugee work. They would try to find transportation for people who were looking to get out of that situation, because it was a very hot zone as far as a lot of battles took place there. And, you know, they have an African saying, which is, when the elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. And this is what was happening to the people who lived in that area. They were the ones who suffered the most. And so they, if they could, they would try to leave there because it was just too dangerous to stay. So they would try to help people get out of that area. Jean and Dorothy worked down in La Libertad, which is a port city just maybe about 35 kilometers from San Salvador. And they did a lot of more structured work. They did catechetical work. They did the formation of delegates of the word. They did women's groups. They also would distribute food that they had received from Catholic Relief Services and other places. Mostly in those days, though, what you did was you accompanied the people, because every other day there was a state of siege was on when no more than two or three people could gather any place. So it was just a very, very difficult, tense situation in the country.
It was also only a few months since the murder of Archbishop Oscar Romero. I mean, how much were these women aware of the dangers they were in?
They knew they were in danger. They knew it was a dangerous situation. The sisters in Chalatenango had received death threats pasted on their doorway. And the sisters in La Libertad were also received death threats, and some of their people had been killed by the death squads. So they were aware that it was possible. However, we were very naive at the same time, because Jean Donovan used to always say, "Oh, I'm blonde, blue-eyed, and North American. They wouldn't kill me." And, you know, we wanted to believe that, I guess, at that time, because up until that time, they hadn't killed any foreigners. They hadn't killed any American foreigners, I should say. The worst we thought would happen was that we would be deported.
What do you think, then, made this murder possible? What do you think changed within the government to allow them to then murder, as you say, people who were very obviously American rather than indigenous Salvadorans?
I don't know. It was like the whole government and military were on drugs or something. I mean, the killing of the union leaders just a few days before, the killing of Monsignor Romero a few months before, they got away with everything. So they just kept doing it. They never paid a price. The arms from the United States didn't stop coming because they killed Archbishop Romero. And it was only when the sisters were killed that the arms stopped for about 2 months. And then when Mr. Reagan became our president, he started supplying them with arms again. So there were no consequences for them.
You were out of the country, weren't you, when the sisters were abducted and murdered. Can you tell us about your memories of that day?
Well, we were every year. The Baranel sisters in the different regions that we have in the world meet for 4 or 5 days to pray together, to plan, you know, what we should be doing and to share our lives with each other. So we had just finished a meeting. That's where they were coming from when they were abducted. So we went to the airport with them. We saw them get on the plane. Then we returned to our mission places. And in those days in Nicaragua, hardly anybody had a phone. So the next day we got a call. The people in El Salvador had to call the Jesuits in Managua. And they went over to where the sisters were. And they said to them, "Did the sisters get on the plane?" As far as I know, they did. And then they said they came up to our house, which was maybe about an hour and a half away. And they asked us, you know, the sisters did get on the plane, didn't they? And we said, yes, they did. And so the thing was that Dorothy and Jean were supposed to go to a meeting the next day, a team meeting in El Salvador, and they didn't show up. And that's, you know, they started looking around, where are they? And in the beginning, they were not too worried because, you know, they thought maybe the sisters didn't get on the plane. Maybe they went someplace else. Maybe they drove the sisters into San Salvador, because many times we stayed with a group of nuns in San Salvador when we were overnight in San Salvador. And they thought, well, maybe that was it. They drove them there and then decided to stay themselves. So they called up those sisters. Those sisters said, no, they never came here. So that was when we started to get a little bit nervous, frightened, scared, prayed a lot. Then the next day, they called and said they had found their the jeep that or the van that these sisters had was burned out on the side of the road. And then we were really a nervous wreck. And as time went on, you know, we kind of shared in some way the angst and the trauma of people who know that their relatives have been taken by government forces and they don't know where they are. They become just disappeared. That could very well have happened with us, except that one of the men who had buried them went and told the priest that the Guardia had made them bury four women and they looked like they were American. And then that priest got in touch with the bishop, and the bishop got in touch with the American embassy, and they went out there and disinterred them and found that it was the sisters. So then they called us and let us know.
It must have been a devastating blow for you personally and for all the Maryknoll sisters, wasn't it?
Oh, it was absolutely the worst. They were the liveliest, happiest, but it with a deep spirituality and a deep love of the people and kind. It was like a piece of the sun had been taken away. And yes, it was terrible.
They had been raped and murdered by a number of military guardsmen, hadn't they? Who has been charged or held responsible for these terrible crimes?
There was a sergeant, and I believe four soldiers were with him. So they're the only ones really that were held responsible. And, you know, they claim they were just following orders. But they knew who the generals were who were in charge of the military at that time. And both of them are now living very happily, thank you very much, in Florida, in the United States.
And there has never been an attempt. I mean, for example, some of the other cases, the Jesuits and so on, people are still now trying to bring to trial those who made the decisions for these murders.
Well, certainly Bill Ford, who was a brother of Sister Ida Ford, was a lawyer. And he spent his whole life trying to bring those men to justice. And it just, you know, just didn't happen. It just couldn't happen. But you knew that they were in charge. They knew what was happening. Somebody up higher had to give the okay to do that. But, you know, we never did find out who it was exactly.
How are these women remembered in El Salvador today? We see Oscar Romero has been now rehabilitated, raised almost to the status of patron saint of the country. What about these women? How are they remembered?
I think they're very much remembered the same way. If you go in El Salvador now, in a lot of places you see their pictures painted on walls and things. So I think they are. For Sister Mora, actually, she had spent like 17 years in Nicaragua. And so she was more identified with Nicaragua. She had only been in El Salvador maybe about 4 months. And so she was more known by the Nicaraguan people. And they used to call her the Angel of the Poor. They were just heartbroken, the people of Nicaragua who knew her. And that was a lot of people. And because everybody that she met, she just had that gift to be able to make people feel that they were really important, that they were. She was so happy to have met them and to have been able to speak with them. They just missed her. And, you know, I would run sometimes into women at the market when I was down in Managua, and they would say, "Are you Sister Mora's sister?" And I would say, "Yes." And they would just put their arms around me and just cry.
What kind of legacy do you think their deaths left behind for the church and for the people there and throughout Central America in those difficult years?
I think, for one thing, their deaths brought to the forefront what was happening in Central America, that people could no longer just ignore it or not read about it. And the wave of solidarity in the United States and Europe and other places for the people of El Salvador because of the deaths of the sisters, because it was such an insult to the church, and it just made you just stand still and say, now, wait a minute, what is this about? Why were these people killed? They absolutely were not killed for their money. They weren't killed for their property. They weren't killed for their political beliefs. They were just killed because they were on the side of the poor. And so I think that for all of the Maryknoll sisters, it was a great uniting time for us and a time to really stop and do a lot of very profound reflecting. And I think for a lot of other people also, from letters we received and what people have said to us and how their lives were affected by the death of the sisters, even though they didn't even know them. So I think it had a profound effect.
3 decades on, that reflection continues in a way, doesn't it?
It does, yes. Interestingly, it does. People will still come up and talk to us about Warren and Ida, or where they were when they heard about it, or what they did when they heard about it. So it is kind of like a landmark or something. It certainly was in the history of Maryknoll.
You're commemorating the 30th anniversary of their deaths with the theme Crossing Borders, aren't you, at the moment?
Well, I think that for one thing, we are recognizing that it is necessary to cross borders, to, you know, go out of where your comfort zone or whatever they want to call it is, and to, because the world is going in such a chaotic situation. So it's going out to other people. And not building walls so that nobody can get in or out, and not depending on wars and guns and things like that to protect us and make us safe. So that's kind of, and the whole immigration problem, the movement of millions of people all over the world due to wars and famine and a lack of jobs and things like that, that, you know, we have got to start working as one people.
My thanks there to Sister Patricia Murray, recalling the life and legacy of Maura Clark, Ita Ford, Dorothy Kazel and Jean Donovan, murdered in El Salvador on December the 2nd, 1980. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Just look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.